What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. Today we celebrate the 24th anniversary of Too Jewish. And it's going to be a great hour of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning's guest is acclaimed novelist Rachel Beanland, author of the new novel, The Half-Life. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This morning we're celebrating the 24th anniversary of our Too Jewish radio show and podcast, an accomplishment, frankly, we're very proud of. And so, in celebration of 1,256 editions of Too Jewish, providing the very best of Jewish radio and podcast anywhere for more than two full decades, well, nearly two and a half, I guess, we are now officially ready for a champagne toast to get us going this morning. L'chaim, on 24 full years of everything Jewish and interesting, brought to you weekly right here on the radio and by podcast, by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, with just one single repeated episode ever, and that was only because of a family emergency medical episode while traveling in Europe. Wow, more than 1,250 shows. Amazing. Here on Too Jewish, we have continued to provide Jewish inspiration, news, humor, music, Torah, and shtick, as well as interviewing the most important and interesting figures throughout the Jewish world every week for almost two and a half full decades, closing in on our quarter century. We pledge to continue always to provide the finest Jewish audio programming available in the world for as long as we're able to do so, which has been, well, heck of a long time now, hasn't it? Stepping into the Wayback Machine, I can tell you that Too Jewish began with an idea one June day way back in the year 2002, when after some casual discussion about maybe doing a radio show someday, I was told, you're starting the first Sunday of August. Starting what? I asked. A one-hour show. I booked the first 13-week block. I gulped. And over the next few weeks, started planning the show. Everything came together quickly. We lined up guests and regular commentators, our mavens, to be on the show. Tom Price, for example, has been with us for the whole of our long run. We then found our first sponsors and figured out how to play musical cuts and do jokes and shtick and such. But we still had a huge problem. We did not have a name for our radio show. We threw out lots of possible names. All Jews Considered got some votes. Fresh Jewish Air did not get support. One recommendation was to call the show Chopped Liver, so when somebody criticized us, and if Jews are listening, somebody is criticizing, we could say, what are we, Chopped Liver? My personal favorite name was Deli Home Companion, but our lawyers told us we'd get sued, and we listened to our lawyers. They are, of course, Jewish. For a while, we called the Not Yet On The Air show Shema Yisrael, Hear O Israel. I mean, that certainly sounded Jewish, and it is central to how we Jews think about things. That was Tom Price's suggestion, as I recall. The quote, of course, is from Deuteronomy chapter 6, Shema Yisrael, Hear O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. One God, indivisible, for liberal and conservative Jews both. So, that was the working name of the show. But every time we told somebody we were going to call our new radio show Shema Yisrael, they said the same thing. That's okay, but it's too Jewish. Or Shema Yisrael? A good name, that's Hebrew, right? Frankly, it's too Jewish. And after five or six dozen of these comments, we got the idea that not only was the show a little too Jewish, but the show title ultimately had to be Too Jewish, because our focus on Too Jewish has always been exploring what it means to be fully Jewish in complicated times. And that's what we've been, Too Jewish, ever since August 4th of 2002. Now, when we started Too Jewish, our goal was to reach out, entertain, and intrigue anybody and everybody interested in Jewish life, ethics, culture, contemporary events, history, Israel, music, film, books, food, art, holidays, humor, as well as anything and everything else Jewish. Too Jewish was designed for Jews of all denominations and flavors, of course, but it was also created to help people who are not Jewish learn about and be inspired by the fabulous religion and culture of Judaism. By exploring all aspects of Jewish life and living without limiting ourselves to one movement or ethnic or national identity, we hope to explain what Judaism really is in the 21st century, which was a much newer century when we started Too Jewish than it is now. That means explaining what Judaism has been for nearly 4,000 years and continues to be today, and for the foreseeable future. As Fiddler on the Roof taught,
tradition.
On Too Jewish, we were going to explain and teach and celebrate and joke about Jewish tradition and make it referable to our discerning audience, you, broadly, with intelligence and humor. But a funny thing happened on the way to the airwaves. We discovered that contemporary Jewish life is about much more than tradition. It is also consistently about innovation. New and exciting things happen everywhere in the Jewish world nearly all the time. Judaism is very much about the process of engaging a great tradition with the best of contemporary life on a constant basis. It is this dynamic process, the continuing evolution of our 3,800-year-old religion into something fresh and new, that's at the heart of Jewish survival and development. And that has made creating Too Jewish each and every week for 24 years now a continual surprise and an ongoing delight. 1,256 shows worth. And so, to play us in on this celebratory morning, here's a Shehecheyanu, the Jewish prayer for all good and new things, originally written by Meir Machtenberg, as sung by past Too Jewish guest Cantor Alberto Mizrahi, a tradition this one. Blessed are you, God, who gives us life, sustains us, brings us to such a happy occasion. We play it annually, more or less, on our anniversary show.
Sir!
That was from the CD by the Western Winds, Abe Mizrahi, singing the prayer thanking God for celebrations like this, our 24th anniversary of Two Jewish Today. When we come back in a moment on this 24th anniversary show of Two Jewish, our guest will be Rachel Beanland, author of the fine new novel, The Half-Life. Meet her when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rachel Beanland is the author of the new book, The Half-Life, a novel. She is previously the author, well, still is, the author of The House is on Fire and Florence Adler Swims Forever, which won a National Jewish Book Award as debut fiction. We've had her as a guest here before on Two Jewish. Should note, I didn't realize she was a graduate of University of South Carolina, and since I was in Spartanburg for 4 years, that almost makes us Lantzmann. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for having me.
So, love the title, first of all. It captures both the reality of dealing with nuclear submarines and radiation and kind of the experience of the protagonist of the novel. Tell us what prompted you to write the book.
You know, so I was one of the only Jewish kids who had a dad who was a naval officer.
Right.
I was always one of, you know, the only kids. Anytime we moved anywhere, I was the representative. My dad was in the Navy, and pretty much my whole childhood, we moved around every couple of years.
Sure.
And we had two tours that were overseas, one in England when I was a teenager, and another when I was 5 years old. We moved to Italy, to La Maddalena. So I had actually lived on this island off the northern coast of Sardinia for 2 years as a little girl. And it was really when I went back to the island for the first time 31 years later in 2019 that I began to think there might be something there and that I wanted to write about it. The Americans had left the island in 2008. So there was kind of a window of time between 1972 and 2008 that there were these Americans living on the island, you know, sometimes in partnership and sometimes in conflict with the Italians. And I just thought it was a really ripe scenario for a novel.
So it seems like a good excuse to go back there and just hang out, because it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I did appreciate the research trip that I took.
This is not like a research trip to, I don't know, Norfolk or someplace. I mean, this is...
No, it was great. And in fact, I had been the writer in residence at the University of Richmond, and I had a travel stipend, you know, to use to do research for a novel. And it was great. But, you know, try telling the dean that you need to use your research money to go to a Mediterranean island.
Off of Sardinia.
It was a little bit of a tough sell. But I said, no, seriously, I'm writing a novel. Sat there.
And you were. And in fact, here it is. We will talk much more with Rachel Beanland about her really terrific new novel, The Half-Life, when we come back here in a moment on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer and this coming fall. Established 7.5 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or attend on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. The Jewish High Holy Days are coming up in about 5 weeks. You can join us at Beit Simcha. Again, go to the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Religious school is starting soon for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us for Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. All of our services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person Friday night at 6:30 p.m. for Shabbat evening celebration services with full music, always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m., always followed by a tasty Kiddush. You can come to services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. And our Adult Education Academy classes, and they are extensive, are all taught live and on Zoom. Not only Torah study, but introductory Judaism, Kabbalah, the Bible, and many other classes, all available. Again, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetcher, a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, T-O-O, JewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So this isn't exactly an international issue, but it surely is an extremely important one. There has been a kind of cataclysmic decline in Jewish literacy in America, I would say, kind of across the board. And maybe it's all around the world. And you have a really good example of something that you would kind of feel like every adult Jew should be able to do and most can't. And it involves gravestones. Tell us about it.
Right. Well, you know, I scroll through Facebook constantly. And I don't do a lot of other social media. I know that I probably should, but I don't. And frequently I see pleas, like desperate pleas. Can somebody please help me read what's on this gravestone? And it's from somebody with an obviously Jewish name. And usually it's somebody who's a relative of the person whose stone it is. And you wonder, like, how did they go through life unable to read names and dates on a Jewish gravestone?
Right.
And when I was a kid, 1,000 years ago, we went to public school from like 8 to 3. Then we went to Hebrew school from 3:30 to 6:30 or whatever, 4 days a week. And that system was in place until bar bat mitzvah for many people. And then some kids dropped out, but other kids continued on to Hebrew High. And, you know, I don't think anybody who went through Hebrew High with me wouldn't be able to read the basics on a gravestone. But I guess not every Jew in America chooses to go on to Hebrew High.
Of course.
Many don't even go to Hebrew school, and I'm not sure how effective Hebrew schools are anymore, because parental attitudes towards education and teachers in general, not only Hebrew school teachers, but public school teachers, parental attitudes have changed radically. So when I used to teach at the University of Arizona, I would see students arrive with high school degrees who couldn't read or write, literally. I had to wonder, like, how did these kids get through grade school, middle school, and high school without learning to read and write? I think that that is a critical social problem that in and of itself goes a long way towards explaining the polarization of political life in this country and the huge degree of animosity. I mean, when people can't talk intelligently about an issue, can't talk in a way that's well-informed, they resort to name-calling. And most political discourse in this country now is just name-calling. There's no substance to it at all.
I think the decline in literacy is extremely troubling. There are a number of factors, and I'm not the expert on it that others might be, but if all of your information is curated by algorithms that just give you the same stuff, and if most of your time is spent staring at a screen that just passively gives you information, and if you need to get something written, you just turn to AI and let it do it for you, your brain is going to atrophy at some point or another. And there's lots of films and lots of analysis of this. I do think the Jewish literacy problem, which has become more and more acute in the course of my career, is to a large degree shaped by the attitude of the adults that think that Jewish, you know, yeah, college education is super important. Learning about your Jewish heritage is, I don't know, fifth on the list after all the other things you're doing as a kid, if that. And it's a severe problem, and it doesn't shape an educated Jewish polity either to support what the Jewish world is doing or the future of Judaism in America.
Right. I think there's another lurking in the background here, at least for American Jews, is our country, long before this century, had a deep-seated bias against intellectuals and intellectualism. And I remember growing up, if you called somebody an intellectual, it was an insult.
Right.
Whereas in a civilized country such as France, being called an intellectual is high praise.
No, there's a definite preference for the common man, even for people that are actually intellectuals. Tom, we will talk next week. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke. The week Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe, a good Jewish son, goes to a pet shop and tells the owner he needs a pet for his mother, a widow, to keep her company. Moshe tells the pet shop guy that Mama lives alone. She really needs company. The pet shop guy says, I have just what she needs. I've got a parrot who can speak in 5 languages. She'll have so much fun with this bird. Moshe says, I'll take the parrot. He makes arrangements to have the bird delivered directly to his mama. A few days pass, and Moshe calls his mother. Well, Mama, how'd you like the bird I sent? And Mama says, oh, son, he was delicious. Aghast, Moshe says, Mama, you ate the bird? Why, he could speak 5 languages. And Mama says, well, he should have said something. That was a variation of an old Jewish joke of the week. You may remember some other parrot jokes I have told over the years. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and don't eat the parrot. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'eh, the fourth portion in the book of Deuteronomy, which follows a sequence of marvelous parshiot with yet another remarkable text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the whole Torah. Ki yihyeh v'chai avyon me'achad achecha be'achad sha'arecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within your gates, in the land the Lord your God will give you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yadcha lo. You must certainly open your hand to him and give him enough for whatever he lacks, whatever he wants, the Torah says. Now, this commandment is not simply to provide the needs of the needy, not just to alleviate their suffering, but to give them what they actually want: sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our own American society, in which the safety net has as many holes as net. It is more than the social protesters in Israel believe their society is providing. It is a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand and surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power, and no one is to be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive. This is not a society run for the 1%, but for everybody else. Herein lies a foundational lesson in Judaism on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion, give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and do so in a way that preserves the recipient's dignity. That is the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and in righteousness. Judaism at heart is pragmatic ethics. We're trained to make the world morally better through practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity must give something to those with less, the rabbis conclude tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of whatever your income is, not a hard figure, and that the same percentage, whether it's 10% or 5% of gross income or some other number, should be given in both good times and bad. Even in crazy, strange, unpredictably weird times like these. It's true, of course, that when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity, of morality must be preserved. So, my friends, open your hand. Give a percentage of your gross income to help others. Do so freely and generously in good times, in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing to do. When we come back in a moment on this, our 24th anniversary edition of Too Jewish, our guest, Rachel Beanland, explains where she got the background for her fascinating new novel, The Half-Life. Both the U.S. Navy story and the sunny Italian island it's landed upon. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Times our news of Jews around the world has morphed into a kind of anti-Semitism blotter lately, and unfortunately so it is today. Over a dozen Torah scrolls were stolen from a French synagogue in an attack the local rabbi called anti-Semitic. This burglary hit the Grand Synagogue of Levallois-Perret, a wealthy suburb of Paris, between Sunday night and Monday morning last weekend. Rabbi Chalom Lelouch said the Jewish community was violated by the theft. It is, of course, a criminal act, but it is also an anti-Semitic act that specifically targeted the Torah, Lelouch said, in a joint statement with Philippe Cohen, the president of the local Jewish community association. Levallois mayor Agnès Pottier-Dumas said that she learned with shock and anger of the attack, adding, "Anti-Semitic nature of this vile act must be condemned." She confirmed municipal and national police are investigating. The Désault de Seine Prefecture, which handles local state administration, said the stolen scrolls represented not just a simple theft, but an entire community of believers wounded to the depths of its soul. Prefect Alexandre Bruget and elected officials met with Jewish communal leaders in Levallois, promising to identify the thieves and secure the return of the scrolls. Cohen said the burglary was the work of a professional team. They bypassed security systems, and the synagogue's security was now, of course, being reassessed. He called the incident a profound spiritual trauma for the entire Jewish community in France and around the world. It was the Torah, and only the Torah, that was targeted, said Cohen. No property was damaged, nothing else was stolen, apart from Torah scrolls of immeasurable value. France recorded 1,320 anti-Semitic incidents last year in 2025. That accounted for 53% of all anti-religious acts, according to the Ministry of the Interior. Jews make up less than 1% of the French population. In other news of anti-Semitism, a coalition of leading Jewish organizations from seven countries released a report confirming 2025 was the deadliest year for anti-Semitic violence in the Jewish diaspora in more than three decades. More than 20 people were murdered in anti-Semitic violence last year, said the J7 Large Communities Task Force Against Anti-Semitism report. The report confirmed an analysis published earlier this year by Tel Aviv University. This J7 report concludes it is no longer accurate to say anti-Semitism is spiking in the wake of the October 7, 2023 Hamas war crimes attack on Israel. Instead, the report says Jews around the world face an ongoing, sustained trend of anti-Semitic violence that requires action from their governments. Anti-Semitism in our seven countries is no longer a surge. It is our new normal, the report says, unfortunately. Governments must stop reacting after Jews are attacked and start acting before, with real security funding, stronger laws, and social media platforms that enforce their own rules. The findings are from the task force's second annual report. It documented more than 23,000 anti-Semitic incidents during 2025 across Argentina, Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The incidents led to more than 20 deaths in 2025. 15 people, of course, at the Hanukkah celebration at Sydney's Bondi Beach in Australia. Two people during an attack outside the Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester, England on Yom Kippur. Two more people outside the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. in May. And one person in the firebombing during the Walk for October 7th hostages in Boulder, Colorado last June. The J7 report identified anti-Zionism as a motivating factor in nearly half the recorded incidents in Britain and the United States, and about a quarter of the incidents in Germany. This J7 group of Jewish organizations, including the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of the U.S., and Australia's Executive Council of Australian Jewry, formed in 2023 in order to improve cross-border collaboration and coordination in fighting anti-Semitism. It plans to release a new analysis of incidents from the first half of 2026 this coming week. In Canada, two locations of Kiva's Bagel Bar, a fixture for Toronto Jews ever since it opened back in 1979, were targeted last weekend. Gunfire hit the windows of one storefront an hour after another storefront was vandalized and its front glass shattered as well, according to the Toronto Police Service. Police say their hate crimes unit is investigating. They believe the same SUV may have been involved in both scenes. The bakeries were closed at the time. Fortunately, no injuries were reported. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said he was appalled by the attacks. Jewish Canadians should be able to live, work, and worship free from fear, intimidation, and hate, he said. Canada's government is absolute in our commitment to combating the scourge of anti-Semitism. Toronto Mayor Olivia Chow added that the incidents were vile and unacceptable and said she will always stand with Toronto's Jewish community against anti-Semitism. Residents flocked to Kiva's and bought out all their bagels by 10:30 a.m. the day after the incident, according to the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, an advocacy arm of the Jewish Federations of Canada. Adrian Roca, a resident and founder of a local real estate company, posted a photo of his employees lined up outside to buy the bagels. The Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs said Canadians rallying around kivas sent a message. There are a lot of good people ready to take a stand against hate, intimidation, and violence. Police searched for suspects in the bagel shop attacks, and while that was going on, a gunman opened fire on the U.S. consulate in Toronto early the next day, setting off a high-speed chase and a manhunt. Police in Canada have not confirmed any connection between the gunfire at the consulate and at the bagel shops. The shootings at the U.S. consulate marked the second such shooting in 4 months. Toronto police have arrested three people connected to the previous consulate attack, as well as several others accused of shooting at Jewish targets in the city in recent months. At a press conference last month, Toronto Police Chief Myron Demkew identified a broader pattern between the shots fired at the consulate and at Toronto area synagogues and Jewish schools over the past year. "We are dealing with, in this case and in other unrelated incidences, including shootings at synagogues and Jewish schools, is a recurring and similar modus operandi. Criminals for hire," said Demkew. "Through encrypted messaging apps, young people are hired to carry out attacks against various targets, and in order to get paid, they're required to film their attacks." Carney pledged back in June to fight anti-Semitism through a new Ministerial Advisory Council on Rights, Equality, and Inclusion. In his speech at Toronto's Holy Blossom Synagogue, he said the country was failing Jewish Canadians. It is. 2/3 of Canada's religion-motivated hate crimes last year were directed at Jewish Canadians, who make up about 1% of the total population. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Rachel Beamland is a wonderful author. Her new book is called The Half-Life. She was the author of Florence Adler Swims Forever and The House on Fire. Florence Adler Swims Forever won a National Jewish Book Award for debut fiction. And this new novel is, I was trying to think of the right term for it. There's a lot of hiddenness in this book, betrayal, but also what the military was saying and not saying. It raises some really interesting questions about honesty and revelation and character. Was that your intent?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, did I set out to weave all of those things into the book? I don't know. But I was very intrigued with the setting. I was very intrigued with the Navy's decision to put nuclear-powered submarines in this archipelago. And I was really intrigued by the fact that the Italians, you know, in this case, particularly the Sardinians, didn't feel like they'd had a big say in the decision. And so particularly in the 70s, which is when the book is set, there was a great deal of unrest between Italian protesters and in some cases, international protesters and the American military, you know, as they were kind of setting up shop. I think, you know, I brought a lot to the book. You know, you try when you're writing a novel never to start out by thinking about themes, but I certainly brought to the book all of my lived experiences, which, you know, included a childhood in the Navy, you know, moving around with my dad, who was a naval officer. And I also brought to the book my experiences as a young wife, you know, someone, I got married at 22. I'm 45 now and still married.
And Mazel tov.
Thank you. I was also thinking about an early marriage my father had had when he was in his 20s that did not, you know, survive. And I am, you know, thankful that it did not.
Yeah, you wouldn't be here, right?
Uh-huh. So I was thinking a lot about that. And I was also thinking a lot about my father's early death. He died in his 50s of pancreatic cancer. And so I was thinking a lot about risk and how we never really know, you know, particularly when people get these early diagnoses, what it is that led, you know, to their diagnosis and maybe their demise. And we have to live with all of that uncertainty.
people don't remember, I'm sure, so clearly if they even knew it, but Italy was, you know, potentially poised to go communist at various times from the end of World War II up through the 70s. And so I think you're capturing something that was quite real, and the U.S. response was always a little bit heavy-handed, let's say. Did it ultimately succeed? I don't know. That's not the real core, but that's the background of the novel.
Yeah. I feel like that was a surprise for me, you know, because I had all of these wonderful childhood memories of living in Italy.
Sure.
And I just thought, okay, it was the Cold War. There were nuclear submarines. You know, we needed a submarine tender to service these submarines. But then once I started researching the novel and I realized just how fraught the situation was, and, you know, the politics of Italy at the time, and this risk that the country would go communist, and really that, you know, the American government had, we had our fingers in a lot of pies. And that was, I think, what drove me to write the novel I ultimately ended up writing.
Well, people also, you know, don't think about the fact that I think it Italian government's changed, like, I don't know, 40 times in 20 years or something. It was a constant insecurity. But as a five-year-old kid, you wouldn't have cared about any of that, right?
No, I didn't. And even in the years after, I really didn't kind of ask myself even, well, why were we there?
Right. What were we doing in Italy, of all places?
Yeah, what were we doing? You know, why were there so many American bases in Italy at that time? And you know, why were we on this tiny island? And, you know, we just felt like we had hit the jackpot being there.
Kind of did, actually, right?
Yeah, we did, right? It was an incredible experience for a young family, you know, to have. And so, you know, it really wasn't until I was an adult and already a published author and sitting there thinking about writing this novel and just reading everything I could about La Maddalena that I came to realize that, you know, my family had actually played a much more interesting role in, you know, geopolitics in the 1970s than I maybe realized.
Your protagonist, Eileen, you know, does some things, let's say. When you write about the complexity of somebody doing, you know, in a troubled marriage, there's no secret. It's clear in the throughout the book. I don't hope I'm not,
right,
like, revealing too many secrets here.
Yeah.
How do you put yourself into that mindset as an author? Still married from your young marriage.
Yeah, right, still married. I really try very hard when I'm building out these characters, and you know, in the case of this book, it's like I was building out her husband Paul, and I was building out her, you know, Eileen, who's our protagonist and who's the one telling us the story, you know, and all of the people kind of around her as she creates a life for herself in Italy. I try to think about every character as not just being, you know, a good guy or a bad guy, right? Like, we're all complex people. And
sure.
Eileen, like any of us, makes mistakes. She makes choices that, you know, she may regret later. She makes choices that the person next to her wouldn't make, right? And I think so much of life is kind of making the wrong decision and then coming back from it. And, you know, I mean, I think one thing we could all stand to recognize is that, you know, you're allowed some do-overs in this life. And I think that, you know, too often maybe we don't give ourselves permission to take the do-overs we need and to go a little easy on ourselves. Because it's tough, you know, it's tough, this living thing. And I think particularly in that era and with the expectations that, you know, a woman like Eileen would have been facing and the limitations that a woman like Eileen would have been facing, it's not surprising that someone could get it wrong right out of the gate. And I was really, you know, when I was thinking about Eileen and Paul, I was also thinking about this first marriage of my father's. And one of the things I was so interested in about the marriage, which I didn't learn about until I was maybe 14 years old, was that my dad didn't spend a lot of time afterwards
thinking about it much. Like he, you know, it was a short-lived marriage. He was married 3 years. He got divorced. He married my mom. You know, they had 4 children together and were married 30 years before he died. And, you know, his second act, if you will, was the main act, right? And so I liked the idea that you can come back from something like this. It doesn't have to be the thing that defines you.
A lot of novelists feel to me like, particularly in their early novels, like they're just, it's kind of autobiographical with a couple of changes. how do you avoid that temptation?
Well, I feel like so far, all of the scenarios that I've written about, you know, a drowning in the 30s that was based on something that had occurred in my family, the Richmond Theater fire, which of course is a well-documented historical event,
right.
And then this one that, you know, takes place before I was born, it's helpful to kind of be so far removed from my own life that I'm not quite as tempted to just retell you my life story. Of course, elements of my life end up in the book, as do elements of my husband's life and my mother's life and my cousin's lives and, you know, whatever. I'm always kind of borrowing, right, from the world around me. But I think maybe partly because I was a Navy kid and I moved around so much and I never really put down roots in any one place, I feel like I have a lot of stories to tell, and many of them are not mine, right? Like they're mine in that I was witness to something, right? But they're not mine in that I live in Richmond, Virginia in 2026. Right. And I'm raising 3 kids and, you know, all the rest of it.
It's a great observation because having to constantly move, reacquaint, meet new people, refresh, and try to fit in gives you a very different perspective than I would say a whole lot of other people, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was raised, you know, by my parents who were an interfaith couple. My mom was Jewish and, you know, her family was from Atlantic City and they lived in Philadelphia. And it was like a very particular kind of experience that she brought to my parents' marriage. And my dad was from the upstate of South Carolina, had been raised Methodist, was, you know, his dad was like the country doctor in their small town. And his stories were wild. I mean, you know, like night and day different from my mother's. And both of those truths, right?
Right. They're
are,
all part
are
of you.
Mine,
yeah,
right? And so it's like, you know, I've written the book about Atlantic City and you know, Jewish Atlantic City in particular.
Very
I haven't
very
written
much
the
so,
book
yeah.
about rural South Carolina, but it's probably coming at some point. And yeah, I think ultimately, I mean, I think I had trouble with this growing up because I didn't know where I belonged. But I think as an adult, that's the gift.
The gift is that ability to be, to kind of be everywhere and anywhere as an author, right?
Yeah.
To people to write about experiences that you've had some experience with or ones that you haven't and be able to sort of accommodate to them.
Right. I mean, like, I spent my teenage years at a British girls' school. Like, I haven't written about that yet.
Well,
who knows?
You know, those are very popular. Those, I can see a streaming show, you know.
Right. So, you know, I just I look back on my childhood now and I'm very grateful for it because I do feel like it is directly affected my career in a positive way.
You write about the Navy. It's not always complimentary. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I mean, the Navy's complicated, right? It's made up of people, and it's made up of people
yeah,
who are all
yeah, yes, yes, it is. I think that's a fair statement. Okay.
Right. You know, but it's also got these like big governmental goals, and you know, it's got people in charge who are making decisions that you know, or I shouldn't call them decisions, right? Giving orders that they expect people to follow. And it's just, it's a really complicated organism. And I think it gets more complicated when you take it and put it in a foreign country and transplant, you know, all of these people to this, you know, tiny island. And I don't want to ever write with blinders on. I really tried to interrogate everything about the Navy's presence on this island. And there were a lot of big benefits for people. You know, I mean, I remember talking to an Italian woman when I went over there to do research, and she, you know, really fondly remembered growing up with all these American teenagers on the island. And she works at a shop, you know, in town. And she said that it wasn't until she went to Rome and was hanging out with some cousins, you know, in her late teens, maybe, that she realized that not every Italian kid knew all of this American rock and roll music. And, you know, but she knew, like, the Allman Brothers and the Steve Miller Band, and, you know, because she was living on an island with American teenagers. And so I love the complications of that, right? On one hand, she was living with great risk that she probably wasn't even fully aware of.
Sure.
And on the other, she was being handed some kind of like interesting cultural gifts. And I think that was true for everybody on the island, Americans and Italians. Everyone was getting something out of it. Everyone was also sacrificing something. And that all those complications make for a good novel.
It is indeed a very good novel. I want to thank Rachel Beanland for another great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the new book, The Half-Life?
I guess go to my website, rachelbeanland.com. And that's got, you know, all the information about all three of my books. And then, you know, you can find The Half-Life wherever books are sold.
And I can't wait to see what you do write about. Maybe it will be rural South Carolina or English boarding school. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. This one, well, the show after our 24th anniversary show. Our guest will be Dr. Anna Goldenberg, trauma surgeon who brought new surgical techniques to Israel during the war, featured in a new documentary called The Asset. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. And religious school is just about to take off. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, for our service and class schedule, to sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership if you have really young kids, and to sign up for the coming High Holy Days in September. Our playout this morning on this anniversary edition of Too Jewish comes from cantor Yaakov Shweki. For our 24th anniversary, it's another Shehecheyanu, the prayer for all good and new things, including wonderful accomplishments like this very show. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and of peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
Oy, Baruch.